A public affairs presentation from Radio St. Pete, the Suncoast Tiger Bay virtual luncheon recorded Wednesday, April the 28th. The topic, the socio-cultural impacts of development in downtown St. Petersburg.
Tigers and guests, welcome to the Suncoast Tiger Bay Club virtual event about the socio-cultural impacts of development in St. Petersburg. My name is Joanna Cheshire, president of the Suncoast Tiger Bay Club and your host for today. Since 1978, the Suncoast Tiger Bay Club has served as a civic commons where thought leaders and citizens of all political stripes come together to discuss pressing issues in our community by engaging in nonpartisan conversations, being curious, and fostering a better understanding of public issues. Recently, we surveyed members about transitioning from virtual to in-person programming. We received 60 responses, thank you very much for your time. 74% of respondents are ready to meet in person. The board will work, the board will work on a plan to do this safely, and we hope to start meeting in person this summer. We've had so much success with our virtual programming that we plan to keep it for those that find it more suitable for them. Suncoast Tiger Bay is committed to bringing these conversations to you and to do it safely. Please help support our continuing commitment to delivering timely and informative programming by renewing your membership, becoming a member, or just donating today. A donation of $25 or $35, which is a reminder of what you would have spent on a Tiger Bay luncheon, will help sustain our club and allow us to continue to keep you informed and connected. Also consider promoting your business or organization by sponsoring a Tiger Bay event. By sponsoring an event, you also support our Young Tiger Scholarship Program. You can contact us for more information on that. So speaking of our Young Tigers, Suncoast Tiger Bay is committed to the development of our future leaders. So each meeting, we welcome local high school and college students into our discussion. Today, our Young Tiger guests are joining us from Northeast High School. Drew Linton is a junior, and Haleen Wheaton is a senior, and they're watching with their teacher, Mrs. Kristen Burkham. Welcome. Thank you for joining us, and we encourage you to participate in our Q&A. So when you do, please indicate that you are a Young Tiger when you submit your question. So for the format and rules, Tiger Bay is all about digging into tough conversations that affect our community. Today, we're talking about equitable development, sustainable placemaking, community benefit agreements, and how this will affect the future of our city's skyline. We're excited to have changemakers on our panel and moderating today. Don't forget to submit your questions through the Q&A button at the bottom of your Zoom screen. You can submit questions at any time during the program, no matter who's talking. So now I'd like to introduce today's panel. Tamara Felton Howard is president of Felton Howard Law and co-chair of the CBA Advisory Committee. Jonathan Graham is president of Horace Construction. Alan Delisle from the City of St. Petersburg, he's the development administrator. And our moderator for today is Dr. Elizabeth Strom, associate professor in the School of Public Affairs at the University of South Florida. Dr. Strom has published widely on tourism, urban development, and affordable housing issues. She holds a PhD in political science from the City University of New York, a master's in city planning from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and a BA from Swarthmore College, Welcome, Dr. Strom. I'll kick it over to you now.
Thank you, Joanna. I'm really pleased to be invited to moderate this wonderful panel on such a fascinating topic. And so I want to get it started by first asking each of our panelists to just spend a minute and a half, sort of giving a further introduction about what they do that's related to our topic of equitable development and the community benefits agreement. So we'll start with you, Ms. Felton Howard. Do you wanna tell us a little bit about yourself and what you do?
Sure, good morning. Thank you for inviting me. I am an attorney here locally. I'm a 40-year resident of the City of St. Petersburg. I have a Master of Laws in Real Property Development, which sort of has led me into the real estate development arena. I am co-chair of the Community Benefit Agreement Policy Work Group, which one community along with several other organizations have come together to promote in the City of St. Petersburg. My co-chair is Dr. Bruce Neeson, who is also a panelist today. And my primary employment is as the owner of Felton Howard Law, where I practice in probate, estate planning, and real estate development law.
Thank you so much. So maybe we'll go next to Mr. Nissen, your partner on the CBA committee.
I'm Bruce Nissen. I'm a retired university professor and lived in St. Petersburg now at Florida International University when I was a professor. I lived in St. Petersburg for the last 10 years or so, and I co-chair with Tamara the Community Benefits Agreement Policy Working Group.
Thank you so much. Mr. DeLisle, would you like to introduce yourself, please?
Yes. My name is Alan DeLisle. I'm the City Development Administrator for the City of St. Petersburg. I've done that job for about, it'll be going on 7 years. I have six departments that report to me, all dealing with development and development activity, commerce, economic development. Those departments vary from parking and transportation to economic development and planning to real estate, the enterprise facilities department, which oversees the stadiums and the marinas and the ports. But most of my activity is negotiating public-private partnerships on behalf of the city, working to make sure that they make financial sense to the city, but also have equity and social outcomes built into them as well.
Thank you so much. And it looks like our final panelist, Mr. Graham, has joined us. Jonathan, can you hear me and can you introduce yourself?
Good morning. Yes, my name is Jonathan Graham, and I am the owner of Forest Construction Services. We kind of specialize in building K through 12 higher education, and health facilities in a couple different places. So we're just a construction manager, and we self-perform metal framing and drywall, masonry, and concrete. So that's a little bit about me.
Thank you so much. So I'm going to start us off with a few questions, and then we'll take questions from the listeners as well. So first, I know we're interested today in kind of general issues of equitable development, but specifically we wanted to talk about something called a community benefits agreement. And I know that for me, this is a relatively new concept and perhaps new in Florida. So I thought we could start out just by asking our panelists who are so knowledgeable in this area to talk a little bit about what is a community benefits agreement. Are there models we can look to? And what are we talking about in St. Pete? How is this being adapted to the St. Pete situation? Once again, I'll start with you, Tamara, if you don't mind, just giving us a little bit of background about this.
Sure. So community benefit agreements came about in the late 1990s here in the United States, and it was modeled after the living wage movement that was going on during that time. You had lawyers and community groups that came together to press developers, especially when you had development in, you know, large urban areas. You might have a stadium or some big project that they were building surrounded by urban centers. And they would negotiate typically the community group with the developer to bring community benefits to the low income community that was surrounding the project. So that has evolved the term community benefit agreements to also include agreements between, you know, cities and developers. What we are proposing here in St. Petersburg goes a little bit step beyond that. It's not just a community benefit agreement, which is like a per, you know, on a per project basis, but a policy or an ordinance that would cover all projects that fall within a certain criteria. So that's a little bit about what they are and what we're doing here.
So Alan, would you want to jump in here and talk a little bit about how a community benefit agreement looks from the point of view of the city? You need to.
Sorry about that. Very good question. So, you know, we took a step back on this. You know, the community did a great job of researching this and bringing forward some ideas to the city. It was very well done, very well thought out. So we got even more serious about it. You know, the Christman administration has been doing community benefit components to its development agreements, and the council has been approving those for many years. You know, we've done it in a lot of the projects that have occurred over the last several years, but it wasn't formalized. And, you know, it isn't something that is standard or is ordinance driven at this particular time. It's really based on the administration. You know, what do they value? What do they want to, you know, see happen in a development? So, you know, we did a lot of research. We looked at all kinds of CBA agreements on larger projects. We looked at ordinances across the country, and, you know, we think did a very thorough job of looking at all of the issues related to CBAs. And what we really wanted to do in the end was come out with a policy statement that says, you know, no, CBAs are extremely important. We need to include them under certain circumstances. And I can get into that when they're applicable, but we should include them in projects that we do in the city, and make sure that it's part of the standard operating process. We want to make sure that we continue the growth in St. Pete. We don't want to kill or you know, diminish the development that we have, the growth that we have, the job creation that we've all worked so hard to create. But at the same time, we do think that the system needs to be fairer and needs to consider community benefits more than perhaps what has been done in the past. And now we've got this great equity conversation going on in our community, and we couldn't think of a better time to do it.
Bruce, is there anything you'd like to add on the topic of CBAs?
No, I think both Tamara and Alan have done a very good job laying out the basic thing. I mean, we could get into the specifics of this particular one. I will just say, I used to live down in the Miami area when I taught at FIU, and I was involved in the negotiation of a community benefit agreement with the renovation of the Orange Bowl in Miami, and also with an extension of a hospital to the south side of the Miami area. So I've had some practical experience, which I expect is one of the reasons why I was made a co-chair along with Tamara of this particular organization.
And Jonathan, as someone involved in the construction process, how is it for you if you're involved in a project that has a community benefits agreement? Does that have any impact on how you do your work?
Most definitely. So I'm going to talk. I'm not so familiar with the specifics of the community benefit agreement, but I'm going to talk about when we get the community involved, the impact that it has on businesses. And I know it from the Moffitt Cancer Center is someone who looks at how we have a community impact and how it benefits the businesses that are local. And because people put effort in setting up agreements like this, the surrounding community and businesses get looked at and are able to build their businesses because of what is put in place by the community benefit agreement. So it definitely impacts the smaller businesses, the local businesses, and I'm just the minority businesses in a lot of areas when that is put in place. In Tampa, with the Rome Yard, a part of that was 40% benefiting the community, the areas around it, things like that. So it is a definite benefit to subcontractors and to contractors and to small businesses when these types of things are put in place.
Thank you very much. My next question has to do with the Tropicana Field redevelopment and how community benefit agreement could apply there. So I know that there's several developers that have been chosen through an RFP process, and they have plans that will be considered. And so how would the community benefits agreement ordinance in St. Pete affect a project like that? How would it be different than doing development like that where you didn't have a community benefits agreement? So Ellen, maybe you want to start on answer that question from the city's point of view.
Thank you. That's my favorite topic. That gets my blood going. The TROP development. We're so excited about the four developers that we have. I mean, these are some of the four best developers in the country. St. Pete is very fortunate at this time to have this opportunity. But the point is, the city is not going to be in a position where we're going to sell that land at its highest price and just get out of the way, right? The city could make a ton of money by doing that, and it would fill up the coffers. There wouldn't be any tax increases for quite a while, I don't think. But that's not St. Pete. That's not the way we're going to do business. We spent 5 years researching, talking to the public, getting input, having discussions with the council about what our goals and priorities were for that site. We came up with 21 principles. We embedded those principles in the RFP, the request for proposals that we sent out to the development community. It was a tough RFP, let me tell you. If I was a developer, I might have run for the hills. Oh no, I'm not going to do that. But we knew, I definitely knew, that there were developers out there that had the capability to pull this off, that could do it, because it is becoming more standard operating procedure that, especially on these larger projects, the community demands community benefits. It's built into the process. And national developers have the capacity to do that. So we made it clear that community benefits were a priority, that they were going to have to look at substantial green space, Booker Creek being expanded. They were going to have to look at affordability, both for housing and commercial retail. They were going to have to look at some of the ideas that we had about Grow Smarter Industries being located there. They were going to have to look at convention space and hotels. They were going to have to factor in the Rays maybe being there or not being there. And they did a fabulous job. I hope everybody gets a chance to read these proposals. And we're having more discussions with them every day. We're learning more about them. And we can't wait to come back with a master developer to continue to work with the community. Because the community, I don't think, is going to want to pass this up. This is going to be too good.
Thank you. Bruce and Tamara, maybe you could then share your thoughts about how a CBA could apply to the Tropicana Field redevelopment site. Do you want to start, Bruce?
I just wanted to say one quick thing. The original draft of the Community Benefits Agreement Ordinance, it wasn't clear from the way that was written that the TROP would actually be included. And the reason was the ordinance was written to only cover those where the city put in about 20% of the cost of the overall project, 20% or more. And since the TROP is going to go into the billions, the city will not be putting in 20%, obviously, there at all. But we are suggesting very strongly, and I'm certain it will be done, that the ordinance be something be added to the ordinance such that when the city puts in 10 million or more, no matter what, that is covered by the community benefits agreement, okay? Because the way that the law is, the original draft was written, it would cover projects of over 2 million, of over 4 million, or over 8 million, depending on which tier we're talking about. And in each case, they would only be covered if the city kicked in about 20% of the cost of the overall thing. So we're suggesting an addition. I'm sure nobody will have a problem with that, that anytime the city kicks in $10 million, the community benefits agreement covers that particular project. So that's one important thing. There's a couple other important things that certainly happen under the ordinance. The developer has to hold several meetings in the community where community residents can come out and speak and say what it is they desire to get out of this thing. So there has to be extensive consultation, basically, with community residents on that. When the city does negotiate final benefits with a developer, there's a neighborhood advisory council that also advises the city on the things that are of most importance to the community and the things that could most be wanted out of this. I'll say one last thing, and then maybe Tamara wants to add something else. It seems to me that probably the most significant in most projects covered by it, including at the TROP, maybe it's more things in the TROP than most. But in most of these projects, I think the two biggest benefits that people would like out of it has to do with jobs and affordable housing. I think those are the two big, well-paying permit jobs that actually provide a career for people, particularly disadvantaged, middle and low income and disadvantaged young workers. And that's extremely important. And we can get into the details, but that's built into some of the provisions of the ordinance. And then affordable housing. Affordable housing is a crucial need right now. And I suspect that will be another really, really big one. Now, there are a whole variety of other benefits, which I won't waste people's time by going into right now. But those, I think, will probably be the two biggest. I don't know if Tamara wanted to add anything else.
Well, Bruce, I've covered it pretty well. But I think the Tropicana Stadium project is the ideal project for a community benefit agreement. Beyond what Bruce mentioned, I mean, access to public, transportation, having... just job creation and hiring local residents is important, and making sure you're paying them a livable wage. So all of these are, there could be a myriad of community benefits that come out of a big project like that. But those are some of the things, especially like affordable housing, and making not only that, but making sure that businesses, local businesses are able maybe to be located in the project area at an affordable rate. And so those are some of the things that can flow out of that type of agreement.
Thank you.
I do think we should add really, really, really quickly. I do think we should add small and minority businesses getting a good portion of the work that's done at this. We haven't mentioned that, and it's really important to get that in there.
That's absolutely important.
Thank you. Jonathan, anything you'd like to add on the subject of Tropicana Field redevelopment and community benefits?
Yeah, I just wanted to piggyback off of what Bruce was saying. One of the huge benefits is, so first of all, going back to what Alan said, I have found that whatever somebody asks a developer to do at the very beginning, they will get it done. So if you put the community benefits or what your requirements are at the very beginning of sending things out for requests for qualifications and things, requests for proposals, they'll make sure that it's done and it's easy for them to do it. So that's why it's so important to have it at the very beginning. What you want done. The next thing is, just like Bruce said, because of these agreements, minority businesses are getting opportunities. It is, in some cases, saving the business because you have taken this opportunity to put this community aspect into the contract, into the proposal form. You are helping the businesses, you are saving the businesses. And so that can't be, we cannot let that go without being said. It helps small local businesses and minority businesses, definitely.
Thanks. So I'm going to take a question I just saw in the Q&A because it relates directly to the Tropicana Field redevelopment. And I'm going to throw this question to Alan. This is from Kanan McCaslin, and he wants to know, how is the city planning on moving forward with a master developer given the recent actions of city council, which seems to have delayed any further action at the moment? And then also, of course, is the uncertainty about what the Rays have in mind. And so, Alan, do you want to share your thoughts about where we are right now?
Yeah, we think the city is in a great place. Couldn't be better from my perspective. And I take, I'm speaking as an economic developer primarily. I mean, I never would have guessed a couple of years ago that we would be talking about community benefits agreements and equity like we are, and have four of the best national developers at our doorstep talking about making huge investments in our economy, and basically redeveloping the hole in the donut, which is 86 acres. We all know how terrible that is. My first day in St. Pete, I drove to the Trop, I parked my car, I got out, and I said, oh my God, this is a sin. From an economic development perspective, it's a sin. I mean, to have a baseball stadium with a big open parking lot, no, that can't happen in our books. And then on top of that, you've got the Rays, who are now appear to be very interested and knocking on the door and, you know, talking to the council and the mayor, and basically saying, you know, we want to stay in St. Pete. Well, 3-4 years ago, they wanted to go to Tampa. So the hand that we have right now is, I think, fantastic for the city. I think we've got to be smart about it. We've got to make sure that we end up with a deal with the Trop site that does benefit the community, and the community benefits agreement doesn't get lost in any discussion. We've worked so hard, the mayor, the council, they've worked so hard on those 21 principles. That's where we're focused. We're focused on making sure that those 21 principles live and don't get swept under the rug. And I'll just say it, I mean, for 30 years, we've had that stadium with that big parking lot there. And we do not want to even contemplate another year where that happens. I mean, we the mayor is saying to the community, this is our opportunity.
Thank you. I think now I'm going to move on to some questions that are of a more general nature about equitable development in St. Pete. One question I have is, you know, it seems to me we've all had the experience of seeing neighborhoods where we see new investment coming in, they become livelier, the housing stock is improved, they're more vibrant, but part of the, it seems like almost the flip side of those improvements is that we see rising rents and more expensive housing that either actively displaces people who live there or makes it impossible for lower income people to move in. So are we doomed to have this as an eternal trade-off, that either we have neighborhoods that are undesirable but affordable, or neighborhoods that are attractive and desirable but they're unaffordable? So what does equitable development look like more generally that allows us to have neighborhoods that are lively and attractive but also are affordable to a range of people? Maybe I'll start with you, Jonathan. Do you have any thoughts about how we can have equitable development in our neighborhoods?
You know, when I think about it, I went all over the country, and I think about how does a neighborhood get run down when it is rebuilt? I think about the plans that we put in place to encompass a mixture of things. So a mixture of housing, a mixture of businesses that can fulfill the needs. And then how do we finance, for lack of a better word, or help in the keeping the maintenance of those areas? That's the big thing, is keeping up the maintenance once we've built them, once we've got the people in the community. The mixture of people is very big, in my opinion. So those things need to be planned out when we look at it, and we need to talk about and think about those things. How do we get the mixture of people? How do we get the mixed use there? And then also, how do we engage or keep people at livable wages and that opportunity. I know that there's some efforts that we have in place to work with Dr. Johnson and some of the other people to make sure that there's training to get people to be able to have livable wages to help with that. All those things need to be thought about to make it a success. Once we have the initial plan, the continuous plan, the 20-year plan to make it a success.
Thank you. Tamer, would you like to comment on that? How can we have attractive neighborhoods that are also affordable?
Well, I agree with Jonathan. I mean, I definitely think that we need to have a very concerted plan and effort to try to ensure that we have affordable housing in the city of St. Petersburg. It's a real problem. I don't know that anybody would have imagined that prices would skyrocket as much as they have. I mean, it's just astronomical. You have, you know, my oldest son is, you know, 30. He's looking for a home, and I don't know that he's going to be able to buy anything in the city of St. Petersburg. Most of the people that I know that are buying homes are going across to Riverview or Ruskin or Manatee. So what does that do to our city when we have longtime residents who want to be here who can't even afford to live here? So we have to really put that as a top priority to try to ensure that our citizens can remain in this city.
Thank you. Alan, what are your thoughts?
Well, just, you know, everybody's made such great points. And I mean, the whole idea of community benefit agreements, I think, goes to this question. You know, it's about tackling probably the hardest equation that we have in our economy, which is gentrification. Community benefits agreements are about not allowing or trying to prevent gentrification from occurring, because it says, no, wait a minute, you just can't go in there and build a luxury housing project. If you're going to get city money, if you're going to get 20% more of city resources to go into an area to build, then there's got to be community benefits related to that. And those are connecting people to employment opportunities in those projects. It's connecting local businesses to that project so that they can work on that project and get paid because of that project. The affordability piece has been hit on, right? Maybe 20%, maybe 30%. The city just did a deal for the old police station site. And, you know, we required over 30%, I think it was 33% workforce housing. We've got another project that we're going to bring to council fairly soon, which is the old MSC building, 31% we've negotiated there. Most communities are around 15, 20%. So we think we're doing pretty good there. That's the reason why you have community benefit agreements, is to change the trajectory of gentrification.
So I see a question that sort of follows up on something you just said. James Gillespie had asked whether the speakers could identify an example of what you consider to be equitable development in the city of St. Pete. So maybe you could reflect on that, Ellen. You just answered my previous question by naming a few developments. Is there something you would point to as saying, this is an example of an equitable development project that the city is participating in?
Yeah, I mean, we did, I'll give you a couple of quick examples. For the pier, we did with Chuck Prather, who owns the Tiki restaurant out there. We did a workforce agreement with him for every resident of the CRA in South St. Petersburg that he hires. We are giving him an incentive based on that. He is hiring those individuals now. Why do we do that? Because we want to strengthen all parts of the city, not just downtown. You know, the old police station site is a good example, because we did, as I said, 33%. That was a city land, right? We took it to the council, worked through with the council. There were several benefits to the community there. There was parking made available to the Edge District, and that's what they wanted. That was their top priority. So we provided public parking in that project for them. We provided 33% of the units will be at workforce pricing, which is 80 to 120% of AMI over the next 30 years. And we required office space. We don't want just luxury housing in downtown. We want employees and employers as well, so that they walk to the restaurants at lunchtime, support our local businesses at lunchtime. And, you know, it's all connected. Those are some examples.
So let me throw that question to our other panelists. Do any of you have projects in mind, St. Pete projects that you've observed or been involved in that you think are good models for what equitable development should look like?
I will just say a couple quick things. One thing I neglected to mention, I keep coming up with the next things, but for the larger projects, $4 and $8 million, there also are environmental and sustainability requirements built into it, which is extremely important. And I'm sorry that I didn't mention that one earlier. But sustainability is a very, very broad way of looking at the world also. So in addition to sustainability in terms of environment, we might think about sustainability in terms of communities and communities with all income levels. In other words, avoiding gentrification and the problems of gentrification. Personally, I cannot see any kind of real long-term solution to the conundrum between growing, expanding, developing, becoming the cool go-to place that everybody wants to live in, which is what St. Pete has become, and that's wonderful, and gentrification, the contradiction between those and stopping it. And the only thing that I can see over the long run that would be kind of a permanent solution would be very, very, very extensive use of community land trusts. And that is because community land trusts would take housing costs out of the market, or out of at least direct market determination of costs. Now, the problem with that is you have to have an awful lot of money up front in order to get to buy the land and to control and own the land. But once you get control over the land costs and can control the housing that's done on top of that, and therefore any escalation of the cost of the housing through community land trusts, you really could get long-term a handle on that and really prevent it. All the other things I think are just subsidies this way, that way, that over time will erode and will go right back into market rates and gentrification will occur. So that's just my own, I'm just speaking personally in terms of the way that I see it. I think we have to put a huge emphasis on community land trusts and money into them.
Thanks. That could be a whole other hour-long topic, community land trusts. Thanks for raising that. Jonathan, what do you think about examples of equitable development in St. Pete? Anything you'd like to throw out there as good model?
So we're fortunate to be working, starting to work on the Deuces project, which Sankofa has been behind. And the whole theme that we're trying to make sure happens, and of course the Sankofa development group is trying to make sure happens, is that we do have equitable housing in that community, and also that we're fitting businesses to help the businesses. So we feel like this project, even though it's not as big as Tropicana project, it's a smaller project, but we're looking at how we can make sure that we have participants on the project that are a part of the community, and that the people who would be moving into these projects would be in accordance with the livable wages. I have actually myself and my vice president have looked to how we can help in the financing. So say the city doesn't have a means to help financing some of these persons who are that we're getting equitable housing for. We have looked to someone that I've used all across the nation to do help with financing at, as you know, 2% and 7-year loans and things like that to help with this. So that's another, in our opinion, another thing that St. Pete is doing, because the mayor has been behind it, city council has been behind it, and to help with fulfilling this projects with equitable and helping with community involvement.
Thank you. Tamara, you want to add something to that?
Well, that was my example as well. I also work with the Sankofa Vision Group. I've worked with them since the beginning in an attorney capacity, but I know that it consists of about 5 nonprofits that are in partnership with the city. And it's intended that funds that come from, I believe, the commercial side of the development, like the payment of the lease rates, would then flow back into the community to a certain extent to help fund additional projects along, for example, 16th Street South or 22nd Street South and that surrounding community. So it's a very creative, you know, project. And, you know, not only that, but having affordable, you know, market rate housing, having affordable commercial space. So those are all the concepts that surround that project. So I think that would be my biggest example as well.
Thank you. So now I'm going to take another question that was posted by Jalessa Blackshear. So we're talking a lot about equity, thinking now about the TROP side, equity meaning what we're doing for the community moving forward. But she asked, I think, a really fascinating question. Will the city consider direct restitution to the descendants of the gas plant district? So in other words, looking backwards, there were wrongs done when that site was created. And so we're sort of moving on to try to make things better in the future, but have we done enough for the people who were dispossessed in the past? So maybe I can start with you, Alan, to know whether that's a conversation that we have in city government.
Well, it's a great question. You know, that one probably needs to go to the mayor or to individual council members, to be honest. But I will say this, that the mayor sent a whole team of residents from South St. Pete to a Harvard Bloomberg seminar about how do we best develop the TROP site and make sure that we are doing justice to the past and that we are involving residents that were displaced and people from that community and the history of that site. And I have just been so impressed with that group of individuals and the work that they have done. They have reached out and interviewed people who used to live at the gas plant district and gotten on record their testimony and their thoughts of what used to be and what should be moving forward. That is one reason why we embedded in the RFP that we sent out strong language about community benefits agreements being part of this and being negotiated and part of those 21 principles that I've talked about. So we're just really, we believe that this TROP development is much bigger than any individual. It's about the whole city. It's about correcting some mistakes, hopefully, and listening to the people that used to live there. Restitution, I don't mean to ignore that, but that's a little above my pay grade.
I'm just wondering if any of the other panelists would want to share their thoughts about the idea of restitution to former residents. Okay, then I will move on. There's a few questions on a similar theme, so I'm sort of consolidating them. A few people are asking about just if we can drill down to what we mean by affordable housing. We talk about workforce housing, attainable housing. And so I should just say that from my point of view as a housing researcher, these are kind of made up terms. There's like no scientific definition of what they mean. But often we can be talking about affordable workforce housing, and we may be talking about serving people who earn 50% of the median income, which is about, you know, $27,000 a year. Or we could be talking about people who earn 80 to 100% of the median income, which is more moderate income families. And so when you were talking about equitable projects that include affordable housing, tell me what you have in mind. And if what you have in mind is indeed serving people at, let's say, 50% of the area median, how do we do that? That's a lot of subsidy that we need to have. So I'm wondering how you manage to reach people at that income level. So maybe, Tamara, let me start with you to talk about what you think about when you think about affordable housing.
I think all of the above. I mean, if you have, you know, a young person making, you know, $27,000-$30,000 a year, or you have, you know, someone who is, you know, graduating from school, or, you know, they want to live in St. Pete too. And we should have opportunities across the spectrum from, you know, 50% of AMI to 120% of AMI. I'm for all of that, all of the above.
Thanks. Jonathan, any thoughts about that? What you think of as affordable housing?
I'm good with Tamara's answer.
Okay, that's a great answer. How about you, Bruce? What do you think about as affordable housing?
Well, as a general answer, I agree completely with Tamara's also. But, I mean, here's my big caveat. The pressures are on to say you're doing a lot of so-called affordable housing and stretching that and making most of it actually end up being what's called workforce housing, which means people making up to 120%, 20% more than the median income. And therefore, you can make your numbers look good because we're doing a good number, but it's almost all going to people who are making average incomes or even maybe slightly above average incomes. So I think the thing we have to keep our eye on very, very much, and from my point of view, push very, very hard, is for housing for people at the other thresholds. And one of them is 80% of the median income. And another one's down there at 60. And make sure that there's sufficient amounts going to those two levels kind of also. As a general rule, I think that every level needs it for sure, but that we tend to slight the people making 80% or less or 60% or less of median income. In other words, as always happens in our society, the poorer you are, the more you get bypassed and overlooked and neglected. And so what I would suggest that we all do is push very, very hard to make sure that there are good numbers of housing being created for people at 80% and even down at 60%. And that we mix it up too, so we don't just segregate people making 60% or low, just all off in one little spot. Because the prejudices against low-income people in our society, unfortunately, are fairly high. Unwarranted in my point of view, but they're fairly high. So it'll take a struggle.
Alan, I'm gonna ask you that question, but I'm gonna make it harder. Because I'm going to ask you that if you think we should be doing more for the people at the lowest income levels, what mechanisms do we have to make that a reality? Because, you know, if you're calling it a private developer, you can't just say, well, create units that serve people at 50% of median and make it work somehow. Some other kind of subsidy needs to be involved. So how do we make this happen?
Right. Well, Rob Gerdes is our administrator for neighborhoods and housing. And he is overseeing the affordable housing initiative for the administration, for the mayor, and making great progress. There are tax credits for the lower end, tax credits that can state and federal tax credit deals that are being done, have been done in the city and are being done that serve that lower percentage of AMI. Is it enough? No. You know, is there enough tax credit deals that are approved in any given year? Absolutely not. That is not city. Where we become more and more active is, and we have done this, and we'll do it with the TROP as well. And that is the value of land. If the city owns the land, we can discount the value of the land and have that pay for the gap that a developer has between the rent that they would receive from market rate housing versus workforce housing or affordable housing. I agree with Bruce. It's easier for us to get to the 120% with some of the tools that we have. The tax credits really get to that lower percent because they dig deeper into that pro forma. But so those are some of the techniques that we have. And then, you know, we've got different pots of money that we bring to the table to invest. And that's where you get into a developer coming to the city for help. And then we start to say, well, okay, if you want help, we understand, but we need to talk about affordability. We need to talk about environmental issues. We need to talk about, and that's really what we're talking about today.
Thank you. I'm going to combine two questions about the TROP development. One is from Drew Linton at Northeast High School, and the other is from Ernest Mahaffey, who I think is not in high school. One question is if you could talk a little bit about the principals that were involved in the RFP. You mentioned that, Alan, I'm throwing this first to you, about principals that were part of the RFP, so maybe review those for those who aren't familiar. The other question is whether the fact that the city will retain ownership over the TROP site sort of obviates some of the questions about gentrification and community development. In other words, if the city owns the land and leases it, doesn't that become almost like a de facto land trust in a certain way that the city can ensure that affordable housing remains affordable, et cetera? So how does the fact that the city retains ownership affect the long-term development? So sorry, I made that very long-winded. Principles for the RFP and how land ownership affects development moving forward.
Yeah, great question. So we would do either a long-term lease so that the city stays in ownership, or we would do a performance-based contract that would only allow them to purchase the land that they've developed after they've developed it, after they have done what they said that they were going to do, which is the essence of a development agreement. We say, you know, okay, we like your development plan. Here's what you're going to do. We're going to write it down. We're going to indicate your investment. We're going to indicate the city's investment. We're going to indicate any community benefits that come out of that. And then we're going to take it to the city council for their consideration. I mean, that's the essence of a development agreement. The principles, the 21 principles, they really vary. We've talked about a lot of them today, conceptually. Affordable and workforce housing is a must. And I think Bruce mentioned, or somebody mentioned, that it's not like, you know, they one can be over here and the other one over here. No, all together, working all together, market rate, workforce, and affordable. So no one could tell the difference of what building is different than another building. We talked about economic development, job growth, grow smarter companies. You know, we've been targeting five industries for the last 7 years, and those industries have grown tremendously. We have more interest from the corporate level in St. Pete than we've ever had before. I worked in Durham, North Carolina, which was a huge marketplace. A lot of companies moved to Durham. I kind of saw that and got used to it. I didn't think that was going to happen in St. Pete, to be honest, but it is happening. We've got more companies looking in St. Pete than ever before. And it gets to, somebody else mentioned training, how important training is, and making sure that we're working with our colleges and universities and our workforce system is in place. And that's happening as well. That has really come a long ways, in my opinion. Some of the other principles are just design, the importance of design, the importance of green space, the importance of Booker Creek and how that's handled, the importance of complete streets, which is a real important principle that this administration has had for 7 years. You know, streets are not just for cars, but they're for people as well, and bikers and runners. So the list goes on, but I'd be glad to share the RFP with everybody because, you know, we think that that's fundamental. You know, if we're going to talk about the TROP, we got to start and end with those principles.
Thank you. There's a couple of questions I'm going to kind of merge together also about zoning and how zoning can affect equitable and affordable development. If we allow higher densities, obviously, then more people are kind of sharing the cost of the land, and higher densities are often associated with more affordable housing. So let me start with Tamara and Bruce, if you want to comment on whether we should be looking at zoning changes, and I think some changes have already taken place, that with an eye to higher densities in some areas that sort of missing middle housing in other places. Would one of you want to comment about zoning as a tool of equitable development?
Well, I will comment just to say that I agree wholeheartedly. I mean, I don't know. I mean, Alan probably would be the best person to talk about what the city is open to or what any future zoning, you know, changes that may come about. But I definitely think that that's a creative way to try to increase density and affordability in the city.
I would agree that higher densities are a piece of what we basically have to very much be pushing for. And so at least I'm not following it really closely. And again, Alan's probably the best one to give us the full answer and what the city's been doing. But I do like the way that the city has been moving toward allowing people to build, you know, in-law type suites back and things like that, changing zoning so that we can have small little dwellings and things of that sort for people moving here. The one concern I would have, and this comes from the environmentalist within me, getting really, really high density out in low floodplain areas where, as with rising sea levels and things of that sort, could be a real, real disaster. So that's extremely critical that we pay attention to the environmental aspects of higher density. But where it's feasible and particularly above floodplain levels and things of that sort, I think higher density changes are extremely good and important.
Thanks. Alan, did you want to comment on how the city is viewing the density issue?
Well, you know, the affordable housing and the zoning was a top priority of the mayor and the city council. I don't know if it was last year or 2 years ago. I'm losing track, but they did pass a major zoning, comprehensive zoning package that included waiving parking requirements in some cases so that the cost of construction comes down and more affordable. So I know that the mayor, the administration, and the council really worked hard. Now, are we done? No. You know, we've been working on the 2050 master plan for the last 2 or 3 years. And I believe that goes before council for approval soon. And that, in fact, I know it goes before council soon. And that is going to open up a lot of new zoning changes because there are a lot of recommendations in that document. And a lot of them have to do with equity.
Thanks. I want to see if I can squeeze in one last question before we're timed out from Kristen Berkum from Northeast High School. And that is whether the community benefit agreement includes requirements for different types of businesses. And she's pointing out that we have a lot of apartment buildings coming up where there's no retail. And so wondering whether a CBA can link retail and commercial development to that would serve residential development. I'll just throw that open to
you're muted.
Whoever wants to address that, please do. Alan, do you want to start or someone else want to?
We don't, as I recall, and I might have to be looking at the documentation here. I don't believe that we specifically call out retail. One of the things that we did try to do is we know that every neighborhood is different and every neighborhood has different needs and different goals. So if a project that where the CBA applies has quite a menu of choices that they can make to discuss with the developer to incorporate into their project. You know, that ranges from, you know, all the different things that we've talked about, environmental issues, affordability issues. It could also deal with local retail, small business. If that's a priority of the community, then that becomes part of the negotiations with the developer.
Thank you. Do we have time for other responses to that, Amy? Yeah, so go ahead, Thomas. What are your thoughts?
I was just going to add that, yes, there is an other category and that can be negotiated between the developer and the city that might include something of that nature.
Mm-hmm. Any other final thoughts about that mix of commercial, how to make sure that we're serving our residents?
I'll just say one quick thing. The community benefits is very, very flexible. So you can fit almost anything that the community really wants into it. That's the beauty of the community benefits agreement ordinance.
Thank you. I apologize to all the great questions that we weren't able to get to, but I think we are near the end of our time. So let me kick it back to you, Joanna.
Sure. Amy, is there anything that we need to know before I close?
No, I think we're all set. Thank you, everybody, for your amazing contribution to this conversation.
Yeah, really. There were some great questions that we didn't get to, but we had over 70 participants listening in. So thank you so much. Really, Alan, Dr. Strom, Tamara, Bruce, and Jonathan, thank you so much for your expertise and just your work in the community for making this place a great, I mean, Tampa Bay, an awesome place to work and live and conduct business. So appreciate your expertise and sharing it with us and your time. And Tigers, thanks for joining us on your lunch break. We are working hard to get together the legislative session recap, which will be hopefully our next event. So be on the lookout for that. Until then, hopefully I will definitely see you in person sometime this summer. We're working hard on that. And of course, if you have any questions or want to reach out to us, please do so.
The Socio-Cultural Impacts of Development in St. Petersburg, a presentation of the Suncoast Tiger Bay Club and broadcast on Radio St. Pete. Find out more and consider joining the Suncoast Tiger Bay Club. Full details at tigerbay.org.